Bloomberg Wealth is brought to you by Merrill, a Bank of America company. Visit bankofamerica.com/Merrill Advice. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, registered broker-dealer, registered investment advisor, member SIPC, a wholly owned subsidiary of Bank of America Corp.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. Welcome to Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein, part of our Best of Bloomberg series.
In this episode, we hear from Paula Vollant, Chief Investment Officer at Rockefeller University.
Ed Vollant has decades of experience investing, and David begins here by asking her for her take on the current market situation and also on the challenges that university endowments are facing. Let's listen in.
Some might say it's a bear market, a correction, but whatever you call it, it seems to be something different than we've seen the last couple of years. So are you very worried that this is the beginning of a path towards a recession?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's interesting because I was reflecting on this the other day that whenever I start a new job, it's right before a big financial crisis. I started at Yale Investments Office right during the Russian bond default and the long-term capital. I started at Bowdoin, my previous job, in July 2000, right before the dot-com crash. And I just started 9 months ago at Rockefeller. So I think there's a pattern here. I originally thought it was going to be short-term because of the whole COVID and the supply chain issues and all of that. But then you have Ukraine, you have the Fed, you have inflation, which I thought was temporary, but now I think it's very much a long-term thing. And I do think we're in a bear market, which makes me manage a portfolio very differently than if we were in the, you know, bull market. We could have, you know, anyone could make money in that. But this is going to be a harder time to generate returns for Rockefeller.
So for Rockefeller and many other nonprofit organizations, they had a spectacular year last year. They had, you know, returns of 40, 50, 60% annualized rates of return. Do you think some of those returns are going to be coming back because now some of the great venture funds they were in are now going to have lower valuations?
Yeah, I think last year at Bowdoin, when I left in June, the fiscal year return was 59%. You had Washington University, which was in the 60s. These were once in a lifetime returns. A lot of it was driven by venture capital. Some venture capital on a dollar weighted basis were up over 100% over the 12 months ending in June. I don't think that's repeatable. It was an incredible piece of, you know, period of time. I just had an investment committee for Rockefeller University. One of the questions was, what are the real marks on these private investments? As you know, private investments are lagged in valuations. And I think it's going to be this gradual write down of these assets. I still believe in alternative markets, and I think there's going to be two problems for endowments. One, a lot of endowments use a smoothing rule for their spending. They use a 12-quarter moving average. Well, you're having all these great quarters, and so if you use that, take 5% of a 12-quarter moving average, you're going to be overspending. The other problem is going to be asset allocation. As the public market goes down and the private alternative assets aren't marked to market, you're going to be way overweight in your private. And that brings up liquidity issues as well. And so right now, I think institutions need to be very prudent, focusing on liquidity, dry powder. It's a time to protect capital, not to shoot the lights out to get some great return. Right now we're in, I do think we're going into a recession, and that's a totally different playbook.
So let's have some optimistic news. Anything good about the economy you can think of?
I believe in American, into the entrepreneurship and the creativity of America. I think that there's some wonderful creativity that you have young people who are concerned about the environment and they're, you know, working on different things. I do think that eventually, I believe in capital markets and I believe in equities for the long run. And I do believe that there are going to be some things that way overshoot, and there are going to be opportunities for skilled investors. I also think that, you know, as Warren Buffett said, you know, when the tide goes down, you see who has bathing suits on. I think we're going to see a lot of that, but there are going to be some great opportunities that come for this. But you have to be patient, and you also have to think creatively, I think.
So when you are looking at an investment, are you saying to yourself, I'm looking for the best manager I can find, and I will hire that manager, and if he or she is good, I stay with them forever. But if they're not good, I will get rid of them. How long do you give somebody before they aren't really going to be performing?
We do lots of due diligence, and so it's sort of akin to what I did in conservation, where you do a lot of testing and work before you actually have the bravery of taking the drawing and sticking in a bath of water. You do a lot of testing. You also have a backup plan for something that goes wrong. I feel like the due diligence process of getting to know the manager, of looking at the sector, of doing comparison, of running analytics on the pattern of returns is something that can take a long time. And but once we're in, I am hoping that we're going to be loyal and in for a long time. However, if I've made a mistake and things change, it could be a change in the team, or it could be some really underperformance that I don't understand or that is unexpected. I want to always have the opportunity to change my mind.
David Swenson was given the job of running Yale's endowment, I think when he was 31 years old, and he passed away at the age of 63. Mm-hmm. So for that period of time, he apparently managed to produce outsized returns for Yale, and maybe about $47 billion of returns overall. So it's a fairly spectacular track record, and you got a chance to work with him, is that right?
I did.
And you also, at Bowdoin, when you were managing the endowment of Bowdoin, you had a chairman of your investment committee named Stan Druckenmiller, also a pretty famous investor. So what was it like learning from David Swenson and learning a bit from Stan Druckenmiller?
They are both amazing teachers, mentors, and good friends.
You're listening to Paula Vallon, Chief Investment Officer at Rockefeller University.
And coming up, Ed, we'll hear more from Vallant and get an insider view on endowments at places like Yale and Bowdoin.
You're listening to Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein, part of our Best of Bloomberg series. This is Bloomberg. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
And you're listening to Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein, part of our Best of Bloomberg series.
And in this episode, Ed, we're hearing from Paula Vallant. She's Chief Investment Officer at Rockefeller University.
And Denise, this is not only a story about investing. It's also about what you can achieve when you keep an open mind and you approach things as a lifelong learner.
Mm-hmm, that's right. One of the most interesting things in this Bloomberg Wealth series is learning, Ed, about the incredibly unique career paths that people take.
Yeah, and wait till you hear about Vallant's.
David begins here, Ed, by asking Vallant about working with David Swenson. He made billions of dollars for Yale's endowment. And also about what it was like to rub elbows with Stan Druckenmiller when Vallant became Chief Investment Officer at Bowdoin. And here's what she said about that.
They are both amazing teachers, mentors, and good friends. David loved to teach, and he would, no question was too silly. And also, if there was an acronym and you didn't know what it was, he wanted you to ask the questions. We also worked really hard. It was like working at an investment bank. You know, even though we were at a university, we did a lot of due diligence. We traveled. We wrote these big books for the investment committee, and he was really amazing. And then he was long range. He thought really long term. Then I came to work with, you know, and I had Stan. And Stan is one of the most talented investors in the world. And he's a very short-termism. You know, he's a macro trader. So the funny thing with Stan, he could give you a great idea. And then the next day you're like, oh, I don't think this is working. And he goes, oh, I sold that yesterday. So he's in and out, whereas David was really long thinking. And the combination of that for me was the basis of, I think, a lot of my success in the investment world.
So let me ask you, before we go back to your background, in the last 10 years at Bowdoin, you outperformed, as I understand it, the investment returns of every single Ivy League university for that period of time, including Yale. So what did David Swenson say to you when you outperformed him?
Well, I always remember we gave him an honorary degree to thank him for training me and all that, and he was very proud of that. Also, one time he was in my office and he was looking over an analyst thing and at my performance, and he's like, you're outperforming Yale. And David was very competitive, But I showed you earlier, he wrote me the most beautiful letter with a quote from Leonardo, poor is the student that does not outperform the master. And David was very gracious. He was very proud of that. You know, he also was very competitive, so he wanted his Yale Cubs or Yale puppies, whatever they were, out there. But he was very proud of me, and he was just a wonderful friend, and I miss him.
So let's talk about your background. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I grew up in a very lower middle class family. My father had severe dyslexia, so he only went to the third grade in school. My mother was a housewife. She never went to college. And when I started, I went to a public high school, and then I started at Emerson College in Boston because one of my friend's parents convinced me that I should go to college. My parents really didn't think about college. And I ended up transferring to a state school, the University of New Hampshire, where I got my undergrad degree in art history with a minor in chemistry because I had discovered art history, art conservation, which I later pursued.
You had intended after graduating college to be an art conservator.
I did. So what happened, I studied paper conservation, restoring prints and drawings. I worked at the New York Historical Society for a while there. I then went to work at the Palace of Fine Arts in their conservation lab, and then I went to Los Angeles, where I worked at the LA County Museum. I did scientific work at the Getty, and then I set up my own conservation studio where I worked with contemporary artists like Ed Richey, Sam Francis. And I was running my own business, and I realized I needed to know a little bit about finance because I was working with very expensive works of art. I was running a studio. And so I started taking a couple business classes at UCLA, and through that I got introduced to Yale School of Management. But I got into Yale School of Management at the same time I got offered a fellowship at the National Gallery of Art, where you and I both serve, the Leischer Fellow, and I worked in the paper conservation lab there, combining paper and paintings techniques for conservation on contemporary works of art.
So you did that for a while, then you went to Yale School of Management?
I did, and I had to take baby math before I went there because I was an artist and a scientist, not a finance person. My husband and I had been trying to have a child and it wasn't gonna work, it wasn't happening. So we said, okay, let's move to New Haven. And of course that was instant. And my daughter was born after my first semester. So I took a break, and when my daughter was probably 2 months old, I went to David Swenson and knocked on the door and said, hi, I want to learn about endowment because I'm going to work in a museum. And this is about David. David looked at my resume. There was no finance at all. And he took me in, and I started filing and helping organize things. And little by little, I got projects to do. I remember he had me do a big research on soft dollars. That was one project I worked on. And little by little, I became incorporated into the investment office.
So you went to work with David on his book, Portfolio Management.
Pioneering Portfolio Management.
Became a classic in the area. So when it was over and you finished writing the book with him, helping him write the book, what happened?
After the book got published by the Free Press, he asked me to stay on, and I came on the team, and I worked in various places. I worked on equities, I worked on stock lending, I worked on bond issuance, and that was in 1999-2000, and that's like right when the .com, and we were doing lots of tech investing, lots of venture investing. We're trying to lock in our returns. It was a really interesting time, and I was fortunate to stay there.
So when did the Bowdoin opportunity come along?
So the Bowdoin opportunity came along because Ellen Schumann, who was previously at the Carnegie Corporation, she was a Bowdoin grad. But she mentioned to me that the Bowdoin had never had an investment office. They just had the CFO doing it, and they used Cambridge. And they were starting to think about bringing in someone to manage the endowment. And so she told me about it. My parents lived in Maine. I loved Maine. So I interviewed for the position, and I came in as associate treasurer, and I reported to the treasurer. Stan was the committee chair. And little by little, I sort of rose up the ladder.
You're listening to Paula Volant, Chief Investment Officer at Rockefeller University on Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein.
And coming up, more on Volant's career path.
And she says actually there are similarities between art conservation and investing.
And she also talks a little bit about investing in art.
You're listening to Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein, part of our Best of Bloomberg series. And this is Bloomberg. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. You're listening to Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein, part of our Best of Bloomberg series.
And Denise, in this episode, we're hearing from Paula Volant, Chief Investment Officer at Rockefeller University.
And Ed, previously Volant was Chief Investment Officer at Bowdoin College, right? And before that, she worked at Yale as well.
And when she was at Yale, she worked with a legendary endowment investor, David Swensen.
Yeah, he made tens of billions of dollars for Yale.
And here's David Rubenstein with Volant and all of that. Let's listen in.
So when you joined Bowdoin, its endowment was what size?
$465 million when I joined, and then it went down because of the dot-com crisis.
And when you left, what was the size of it?
It was $3 billion, and that's after spending. I mean, one of the things I didn't say about David is David was really about the mission. He could have worked anywhere and made so much money, but Yale was in his blood, and he cared so much about making money for financial aid. At Bowdoin, I'm very proud of the fact that Bowdoin could stay need blind and that we could enlarge the financial aid so students that could never dream of coming to a school like Bowdoin could come because of the endowment growth.
Now, if somebody's watching this and says, Paula Volant is a role model for me, she came from a modest background, got her degrees, worked with some famous people. Now she's running the investment and endowment for Rockefeller University. I want to be like her. Mm-hmm. What does a person need to do? What do you recommend that somebody do to be prepared to have your kind of job?
Well, I think a lot of times it's serendipity and being open to something that comes along. Like, for instance, I was pretty brave to knock on David Swensen's door. I didn't really know who he was at that time, but I wanted to learn. I think a lot of times it's taking a chance.
But did art conservation help you in any way to be a better investor? And should a lot of good investors learn how to be an art conservator as well or not?
I think in conservation and art history and liberal arts, I think differently than a lot of people that have just done finance. And also, I think I mentioned one of the things is to do conservation, you have to really do a lot of work, pre-work, before you actually do a treatment. And so a lot of that pre-work is very similar to what I do in due diligence for investments. You know, lots of testing, lots of thinking about what could go wrong, lots of research. You know, when I was an art historian, that was in the old days before the internet, but you'd sit in the stacks and you'd pull one thing in a bibliography on this and you'd pour like a mosaic theory, put all these things together. I feel like I do that in my due diligence. And I think differently than a lot of my peers.
So let's talk about one area where some people say there's a bubble, and that's an area you might know pretty well called art.
Mm-hmm.
As we're talking, there have been some big art auctions in New York where staggering prices were paid, I think almost $200 million for one Andy Warhol painting. Do you think there's a bubble in the art market?
I do think there's a bubble somewhat in the art market, but I believe that a lot of people are trying to put their money in hard assets that can appreciate over time, although maybe the Warhol, these are one-of-a-kind works, you know, pieces, historic pieces of art. I think there's definitely a bubble in NFTs, which are a new thing in the art world. I think maybe a few of them will be very valuable, but I think a lot of it is speculation. I do think I collect art myself, and I collect art that I love, that I want to see on my wall, and some of it is very valuable. But I appreciate artists. I think art is a very important part of my life, but I do think some of the prices that are doing there are people who have a lot of money on the side and are trying to put it somewhere other than the market.
So let's talk about the best investment advice you ever received from anybody, either David Swensen or Stan Druckenmiller, anybody. What's the best investment advice you ever received?
Was to admit mistakes, that's one, and also to be brave. I think like after March 2020, when you saw the downturn, then I wanted to make sure that after that, managers were putting risk back on, and I think you can't you know, you have to be brave. And I think, and then from Stan, the risk management is something that is really key to how I think about management.
Now, you've seen investors who are professional and non-professional over the years. What do you think the most common mistake is that investors make?
Yeah, I think right now there's so much fast news. Like, you get news from all over the world, some of it different and all that. And I think there needs to be patience. And also, people like the meme stocks and some of those things, people get caught up in a lot of these really quick money-making things and all that. I think in the long run, for a person who has an investment portfolio or a retirement fund, they should be thinking in the long run, and they should have mutual funds mostly for, you know, I always say, don't do what we do in endowments at home, because you can't do some of the things that we do.
And you're listening to Paula Vallant, Chief Investment Officer at Rockefeller University, on Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein.
And coming up, we'll hear from Vallant on what you should think about if you want to invest your own money.
Also, her thoughts, Ed, on cryptocurrency.
And she talks about the best investment she ever made.
Yeah, you might be surprised to hear what it is.
You're listening to Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein, part of our Best of Bloomberg series. And this is Bloomberg. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
And you're listening to Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein, part of our Best of Bloomberg series.
And in this episode, we're hearing from Paula Vallant, Chief Investment Officer at Rockefeller University, about investing money, large amounts and small.
So here's David Rubenstein with Vallant. Let's listen in.
So let's suppose you're at a cocktail party in New York or Maine or wherever it might be, and somebody is told you manage the endowment for the Rockefeller University. They say to you, well, I have an extra $100,000. What should I do with it? What do you tell the average person who, for $100,000 might be a fair bit for an average person, what do you tell them to do with their money?
Well, right now I would say, I think you need to wait a little bit. Don't dive right there in the market. But I would say do a diversified portfolio. You need to think about what your cash flows are going to be. Like at Rockefeller, the first thing I do every Monday is look at our cash flow needs, capital calls, spending, all that. I want to see what the cash is. So I would think you need to look at your liquidity needs. And then you need to invest mostly in mutual funds for smaller investments, because you can't get into some of the funds that we're in. And then also, you know, different sectors can be very interesting, but a lot of index, you know, S&P 500 to make you sleep at, you know, well at night, not so well this time.
So, but are you an investor in cryptocurrencies, or what do you think of the whole crypto world?
Yeah, I do think the crypto world is something that's going to stick with us, and it's developing. I think that the blockchain is, you know, it's sort of like when we thought computers, you know, the first days of the computer, you thought only scientists would use it. And I do think it's an asset class. We are doing gaming, and we're also learning about the metaverse, which I think, you know, some people think it's silly, but we're doing a lot of work on that, and we've made small investments in that to learn about it.
So you look back on your career, what would you say is the greatest piece of luck you had?
Biggest luck was just serendipity, all the great opportunities I've had, whether it be working at Bowdoin College in the museum to, you know, meeting David Swensen. There's a lot of paths in my life that I think were just serendipity, so I'm happy for that. I think one of the best investments I ever made was my beautiful house in Maine, which I love, Maine is in my blood. It's great.
And you've been listening to Paula Vallant, Chief Investment Officer at Rockefeller University, on Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein, part of our Best of Bloomberg series.
All right, let's turn now to another legendary name in the world of investing, Abby Joseph Cohen.
Right, former partner at Goldman Sachs. Now she's a professor at Columbia Business School.
Right, and she tells Bloomberg's Tom Keene, Lisa Abramowitz, and Kaylee Lyons the investment game is changing as we speak.
For the last few years, the fundamentals have mattered less than things like momentum and investor enthusiasm. Now, you take a look, for example, at the strong correlation between the technology stocks, cryptocurrency, and so on, and basically say these are financial assets in which valuation approaches really didn't matter very much. And I think we're now back into a period in which it does matter, where it's the fundamentals of earnings, the fundamentals of margins, the fundamentals of inflation and interest rates, and putting that all together in terms of appropriate valuation models, that will make a big difference for investors going forward.
Abby, how do you model the fundamentals at a time when people can't game out whether we're going to have a sanguine economy or a hard landing that looks something like a depression? At what point do you game out recessionary outcomes in your fundamental analysis?
Yeah, you know, there are two different ways to look at that, Lisa. First of all, we can game out alternative scenarios. So we have some sense of what the range of possibilities might be, not just for equities, but other financial assets. But of course, at the end of the day, an investor or portfolio manager has to say, what do I think is the most likely scenario? You can always plan for the worst if you have very little risk tolerance. You can always plan for the best if you're highly risk averse. But I think many portfolio managers are aiming for something in the middle where they're trying to identify what is the most likely scenario.
Right.
What seems to be priced in right now is a mild recession, certainly not a severe recession.
When you look at the parameters, do you look at the end of the era of free money, or do you look at just simply a pause, a momentary reprieve from the ultra-low rates of more than a decade as we try to curtail inflation, and then a reversion back to that at the end?
Yeah, let me adjust the question just a little bit, Lisa, and to say that money isn't free anymore, but in many cases, it's not particularly expensive, particularly by historical standards. And so while we have seen this rise in interest rates and the Fed is likely to continue to move those short rates higher, we've already seen quite an increase in the intermediates and the longs and the rates that affect consumers, for example, through mortgages. And so what we have to recognize is that when money becomes more expensive, in some ways, investors, households become much more careful with it. Because if it's no longer free, you're going to see less leverage, which is a good thing in portfolios. For example, we've had incredible returns in some private equity portfolios. Maybe the basic returns were good, but in some cases they've been turbocharged by significant amounts of leverage, which sort of hide the underlying skill set, if you will, of a portfolio manager. And then, of course, there are many corporations that took advantage of very inexpensive money to leverage up their results. And so when money is no longer free, we get to see a better picture of whether those corporate managers and those portfolio managers are actually doing a good job.
Well, Abby, you talk about how people are more careful with their money in this kind of environment. And we know that it wasn't just, you know, corporations and big port institutional investors that were moving money around during the pandemic free money area. You also had stimulus that was fueling the retail investor, and they have been a force within these markets. What happens when that goes away?
What we are looking at, of course, is a situation in which individuals in many cases became overly enthusiastic about some areas of the market, equities and elsewhere, including digital currencies that offered good momentum. And what we are moving into and have already begun to see is what happens when the momentum breaks down and you need to start looking at the valuations per se. Now, individual investors, of course, have many different factors that they need to be concerned about. Some of it has to do with how much longer they have in their investment horizon, what else they might need the capital for, and so on.
Right.
And so we may, in fact, see less money going into things like cap-weighted ETFs. We've not yet seen the intermediate aspect, and I don't think it's going to be all that bad,
Abby, frankly.
Just looking at the demographics.
Do I need to go down substantially to find a base to own equities?
We are now, I believe, Tom, in a situation where beta will be less important than alpha. And that
Explain that, please. That's really important. Explain that.
Investors always think that they are smart in a bull market, right? So if you're invested in a bull market, almost anywhere in a bull market, the beta of the market, and that has to do just with slopes of lines and so on. Don't confuse basically a bull market for genius. And so that's beta. Alpha is security selection. And one of the curious things about the last 2 to 3 years in particular is that it's been really hard to get alpha. So investors, professionals who've used sophisticated approaches, trying to identify what particular securities they wanted to invest in, often stumbled because alpha didn't matter very much. With this dramatic reset in the markets, the overall decline, number one, number two, the breakdown of the momentum orientation, yeah. And number three, the recognition that the economic cycle itself is shifting. We see a move now, I believe, toward alpha, and that's not just within the U.S. equity market. It's likely to happen in other developed markets as well. Yeah. And also, think of it more broadly in terms of asset categories that are no longer all going to be moving in lockstep.
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to go, Abby, and we just have about a minute left. Does this mean that it's the end of the sort of standard 60-40 in terms of just working and needing a more nuanced, scalpeled approach, even with asset allocation?
Let's recognize that 30-year plus period in which inflation and interest rates were under good control and continue to move lower is over. That doesn't mean that a year or two from now, inflation will be under incredible uncontrol and interest rates still dramatically rising. I don't expect that. But we are exiting that 30-year period in which fixed income securities were a very good place to be invested. And that 40% rule right now may not be such a clever thing. One other point, if I may, that Aristotle paper talks about the importance of understanding the data. Let me give you one example right now. There's so much focus on headline CPI. You guys have done a great job of contrasting headline CPI to core CPI. What the Fed is looking at is the better measure, which is core PCE, which is running 3 to 4 percentage points below the headline CPI. So rather than looking at like an 8% number, they're looking at a number which is 5% and maybe a little bit lower. It's still a rise in inflation. I don't mean to suggest not, but it is not quite as awful looking as the headlines would suggest.
And that was Abby Joseph Cohen, professor at Columbia Business School and former partner at Goldman Sachs, with Bloomberg's Tom Keene, Lisa Abramowitz, and Kaylee Lines.
And that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Best, featuring Bloomberg Wealth with David Rubenstein, part of our Best of Bloomberg series. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
And this is Bloomberg.